from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Is obesity really a disease? That's what the American Medical Association concluded last week, a decision that will impact everyone from doctors to patients to insurers. And that, of course, was part of the point. By classifying obesity in such a way, the AMA is pushing both doctors and overweight Americans to confront what is too often ignored, that nearly 80 million Americans and 12 million children are obese. But is it really a disease, since you can be quite overweight and still quite healthy? And will calling obesity a disease serve only to further stigmatize that condition? What's in a name? Obesity and disease. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. 3 years ago, the Stop Obesity Alliance, a government, business, labor, and consumer group, conducted a survey to find out how often overweight Americans and physicians talk to each other about that condition. The answer was, not much. It wasn't that doctors or patients didn't think there was an issue. After all, nearly 80 million adults in this country are considered obese. It's just that neither were sure what to say or how to say it. Last week, the American Medical Association made a determination that it hopes will push that conversation to the forefront. It classified obesity as a disease. Will that classification prompt necessary conversations and treatment, or will it only serve to further stigmatize the condition? That's just one of many conditions and questions surrounding the AMA decision, questions that we turn to in this hour of Forum. Joining us for that conversation, Alyssa Eppel. She is professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, where she directs COAST, which stands for the Center for Obesity Assessment, Study, and Treatment. Professor Eppel, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us, too, is Dr. Christine Madsen. She is a pediatrician at UCSF and an assistant professor at the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health, where she researches childhood obesity. Dr. Madsen, thanks for being with us as well.
Thanks, Dave.
And here in our studio, Virgie Tovar. She is the editor of an anthology called Hot and Heavy, Fierce Fat Girls on Love, Life, and Fashion. Virgie Tovar, good morning as well.
Good morning. Thank you.
So thanks all very much for being part of this really interesting subject, question, and conversation. And I want to start by asking a question about definitions, because after all, the AMA has now provided a definition, which is that obesity is a disease. I want to start, though, by asking a prior definition, which is a definition of obesity and what it means both scientifically, medically, but also personally. Alyssa Eppel, why don't you start us out by giving us your own definition of what obesity is?
So we really describe disease in our society in somewhat of an arbitrary way. There are disease processes that are a natural part of aging. And as we age, we are all developing some breakdown that we, at some point, at some arbitrary cutoff, call disease. So, for example, for diabetes, when your blood sugar gets a certain level, we call it diabetes. But it's all on a continuum. And when it gets to be, you know, quite problematic, we call it disease. So we have called obesity a BMI of 30 or above.
And that's body mass index?
Body mass index. And this label is very categorical, but actually at a BMI of 30, you have the majority of people with some risk factors of obesity-related conditions like hypertension or insulin resistance, and you have a big chunk of those people, around 20%, who are completely metabolically healthy. So it's a very crude marker. It's a phenotype that is associated with underlying disease. So it's really just a risk factor. It's not true disease.
And in terms of, so that we understand our terminology, body mass index is a little complicated to understand. Can you give us a quick layman's definition of it, please? And perhaps an example of how, what it would take for someone to meet that definition.
I'll let Chris do that.
Okay. All right. Dr. Madsen.
So body mass index is basically your weight divided by your height.
And we divide by your height a couple of times because we found out that that's actually the best way of predicting risk. But for example, for an adult who's 5'5", right, which is the typical height for a woman, at a cutoff of about 180 pounds, a woman of 5'5", or a man for that matter of 5'5", would be considered obese. For someone who's 6 foot, that cutoff is 220 pounds. And as Alyssa was saying, you know, there are some people who meet this criteria for obesity because their body mass index falls above that number, but they may be completely healthy. When we get to kids, we don't have cut points for kids because kids' body mass index is actually changing over time. And when, you know, from the age of 2, your body mass index as a kid actually drops because your height's kind of going up faster than your weight. And then somewhere around 6 or 7, you begin to increase your body mass index and you end up at, you know, a healthy adult level, which we think is somewhere between 20 and 30.
Now, you've both already said something which intrigues me, and then I want to pull Birgit Tovar into our discussion of definition. But you've both referenced the fact that it's possible to be obese and healthy, which seems counterintuitive and would also seem to suggest or raise at least the question, how can it be a disease if you can have that condition and be healthy? Dr. Manson?
Well, I think that's why there's so much controversy around this decision. You know, when the AMA issued this decision, actually a couple of days before that, they issued the findings from their council that they had convened on whether or not obesity should be a disease, and the council actually said, no, we should not call it a disease. And I think the one thing everybody agrees on is we really don't know what we mean when we say disease, and we're really not sure if obesity would meet a strict definition of it.
So where do you come down on that? Do you consider it a disease?
I don't consider obesity a disease, and I think it's because exactly what you had just noted is that there are many people who are heavy but may be very healthy. And what I think is much more important, actually, as a criteria for deciding whether or not someone's going to have trouble because of their weight is whether or not they're physically fit. So when we look at aerobic fitness, you know, how fast can you run a mile? Can you run a mile? You know, can you walk a mile? But that actually is a much stronger predictor of someone's morbidity, you know, whether or not they're likely to die from cardiovascular disease or, frankly, from other diseases as well. And mortality and morbidity both are more strongly linked to fitness than they are to fatness.
We'll return to that question as our conversation proceeds. That's Dr. Christine Madsen, a pediatrician at the University of California, San Francisco. But Birgit Tovar, let me ask you for your definition of this. As someone who cares about this issue, who's someone who just before we went on the air said, you can use the word fat, it's okay. tell me how you see this as someone who has that as an issue, or is it an issue in your life?
I mean, what are you asking me if my fatness is an issue in my life?
Yeah, and how do you see this? How do you define that word? Do you define it as a condition? Do you define it as who I am? Do you define it as a disease?
Well, I'm a social scientist, so I think of it as an identity. And as a sort of feminist social scientist, I think of the demarcation, the classification of fat as someone who identifies in that way. And that range is enormous. I mean, I've seen in my work that there are many women, I often work with women, so many women who write me who would certainly classify as healthy on the BMI scale, but who think of themselves as fat. And I think that's when you get into the stigma element of fat and this anti-obesity rhetoric that's part of this AMA decision, I think, you start to really see the complexity of the psychological effects of something like fat phobia.
So do you think that this definition, by defining obesity as a disease, does more harm than help?
Absolutely.
And in what way? How will it be harmful?
Well, I'm really interested in stigma. And stigma is sort of perhaps maybe a fancy term for discrimination and the effects of discrimination. And so, for example, there's a thing called health-related stigma, which is essentially once a condition is considered a disease, or once, let's say, fatness is considered a disease, there's not only the pre-existing fat phobia that a fat person might be dealing with, in addition to the stigma and stress of other potentially marginalized identities, like those related to race or gender or sexuality, you're talking about what I call stigma loading, which is adding more stigma to already pre-existing stressful stressful experiences.
Professor Eppel, come back on that, if you would, to what Virgi Tovar is saying in terms of the impact of stigma on people's lives. As someone who works in the realm of psychology and psychiatry, I'm intrigued to hear how you would respond to that and whether or not in the end you do see this as a disease and that that is a definition that's more helpful than harmful.
Difficult situation and double-edged sword, this policy. Weight bias and stigma is very, very serious. We as a society still think it's okay to, you know, to discriminate and have fat jokes, et cetera. But it turns out that, you know, especially for kids, we can really see the consequences of weight stigma. They get teased and excluded. They tend to have more depression, anxiety, low self-esteem. It can even affect their school performance. So starting very early on, there are very dramatic effects of stigma on a person's identity and self-worth that could be could last, you know, throughout their life and have effects. Now, the other piece is weight stigma can cause as Virgie said, another stress response on top of the, you know, normal stress response of that we all have. So we have found biological effects of stigma as well on top of the effects of obesity. So it's very a very difficult situation because it's true that labeling obesity as a disease is inevitably going to add stigma. And so the question about whether the benefits of this label are going to outweigh the costs is really unknown, and it depends on how we implement this policy and how wise we are when we do it.
Do you think? I mean, do you think it is that there is benefit? And if so, what would those benefits be?
Well, the obvious benefit is that it is going to enable this discussion between people and their healthcare provider, which can be helpful and further enable the resources for the more intensive counseling or supportive and behavioral programs for those at risk. So there's tangible potential benefits that are going to be very helpful and important, but there are two other pieces. One is, are we going to pair this with education that obesity is not due to a person's failure and moral weakness, but rather that there are social roots of obesity, that it's due to the toxic food environment, to poverty. Poverty is clearly obesogenic, and interaction with one's personal genetics. And so so this kind of education about how we view obesity is tremendously important, especially if we're going to call it a disease. And the second piece is we have to realize that it is, if we're going to call it a disease, it's a social disease. It's rooted in our environment, and that's just incredibly clear at this point and undeniable, that it's not our genetics that have caused the epidemic, but rather the change in our toxic.
So in the end, Professor Eppel, do you come down on the side that those possible benefits are worth it? Do you come down on the side that it should be labeled a disease?
I think if it's implemented wisely, that it could be very beneficial. So if we pair this with both education about the causes of obesity and also putting the money where it counts, which is actually not just an individual treatment, but in prevention. So in the AMA statement, they both are wanting to support individual treatment as well as prevention. And the prevention is the only place that I believe these efforts are going to help us. I think that dieting is a complete failure, and the few people who are successful on diets know that it's a lifelong, very effortful condition to manage this, to try to keep your BMI lower than it has been in the past. So really changing schools and institutions and really trying to help us as a society change the caloric balance.
Alyssa Eppel is professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco. I want to ask a pragmatic question, Dr. Madsen. When Professor Eppel made the point that this will push having those conversations, push perhaps people getting into treatment, there's a pragmatic part of this, as I understand it, which is that by giving it this label, doctors will now feel like, okay, it's something that I can talk about because I can bill it. My insurance companies will cover this conversation. It won't be something amorphous that there isn't a code for. Is that right?
Well, there are codes now that people can use to bill. So that it actually doesn't, from a practical standpoint, change that, although reimbursement is bad. And so what it may do is start a conversation with Medicare and, you know, with potentially insurance companies where they will reimburse more for these visits, and it just makes it easier for physicians to code. So with that, I do think that there's some promise there. The other big sort of pragmatic and financial potential benefit is that there'll be a greater focus on drugs that treat obesity, which is actually one of the concerns that I have, because once you make obesity the disease, and it's really now about reducing size and reducing fat, you haven't talked about reducing the things that really matter, which is, you know, reducing sedentary time and reducing exposure to toxic food. So I feel like we're shifting now to a much more medicalized model. And like Alyssa, I really feel that we've made great strides in focusing on the environment and talking about the fact that it's really a lot about access and availability of you know, healthy foods, and the fact that there's just this abundant, cheap, really unhealthy food now, not just in America, but we've sort of spread this across the world as well. And that, I think, is a concern. I don't want to shift that focus from an environmental approach to, again, going back to the more individualized approach.
We want to open up our phone lines to all of you in our conversation. How do you see this issue? Do you think obesity should be classified as a disease? If you're someone who is contending with weight in your life and wonders whether or not this is something that ought to receive this sort of medicalized approach, we'd love to hear your perspective. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Virjee Tovar, do you agree with that assessment that we're hearing from both Dr. Madsen and Professor Apple, that while this is an issue, it medicalizes it to too great a degree, so that we're focused on either surgical approaches or pharmaceutical approaches, as opposed to these questions of social stigma, of the food environment, of exercise, fitness, and all the rest?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I absolutely agree in the sense that medicalizing this issue is really problematic for the reasons that, you know, were previously stated. I think that one of my bigger concerns is that this disease is being determined, or, you know, the disease status is being determined through what I interpret as an already biased measure. BMI is clearly a biased measure. It does not
Why is it biased?
It does not take into account the diversity of bodies. It does not take, thinking about a heterogeneous, certainly an ethnically heterogeneous and culturally, racially heterogeneous nation, it does not take into account all kinds of bodies. I think about the history of my own family, some of whom are indigenous Central Americans. And the body type of an indigenous Central American is short and fat, you know, sort of big. Bone density is different.
I understand the point and the concern, but how do you come back to the concern of the sort of broader social economic costs of weight and obesity in this country, that it is something that is, if nothing else, certainly a precondition or a risk factor for health problems that cost the American economy hundreds of billions of dollars, whether that's in cardiovascular disease or type 2 diabetes. So is there not a greater good, a greater need to contend with that part of this equation?
I'm dubious, I have to admit. I mean, I agree with Christine and Alyssa in the sense that I think that when we're talking about this issue from the standpoint of a risk factor, you know, yes, it can be a risk factor. That does not mean it always is a risk factor. I think it's clear in my work, certainly in communities like Health at Every Size, which is an activism community, I see people grappling with these issues. And I see activists and individuals taking on these issues. And I don't really feel that I don't really see the inclusion of AMA as a particularly – I don't feel like this classification is particularly productive, and I don't support it.
And so add to that, Dr. Madsen, given that it sounds like all of you to a degree have some degree of pause about this definition and whether or not it will achieve its stated aim. But as a pediatrician, Christine Madsen, how do you see this on the side of the toll that it may take on children in particular and the health risk that those children are at if they are gaining way too much weight way too early in life.
Right, and I absolutely believe that as you move up on that BMI scale, so for adults, you know, going from a 30 to a 40, clearly there is increased risk because clearly it is associated with very unhealthy fat. And the same thing for kids, you know, at a particular age, at a particular weight, the heavier they get, they are accumulating more fat, and it's not going to be healthy. I think the flipping that on its head, though, why is it that it's only in the last 30 years that this has become such a problem? We've always had heavy people, mm-hmm. but it's never been a huge burden on society. And now in 30 years, it's suddenly the most expensive health condition we have.
The most expensive?
The most expensive.
Arguably because?
The most expensive. Because it's associated with so many diseases that people end up in the hospital with. So at this point, when someone shows up with diabetes in the hospital, 70% of those with diabetes are obese. And so to the extent that obesity is implicated in the development of diabetes, yeah, it has become a really expensive problem. But if it's only in the last 30 years that it's become an expensive problem, then the real source of this is not this individual disease of obesity, because it wasn't a problem 30 years ago. It's really the environment. So this, I agree that there is increased risk with carrying extra weight. The more weight you carry, the greater the risk. But I think, again, it's shifting the focus from the real culprit, which is a really bad environment, and an industry, frankly, the food and beverage industry, that has completely caused this epidemic that we have, but is nowhere to be seen in this new statement from the AMA.
Let's start hearing from our listeners this morning and what you think about this particular designation by the AMA and how you are contending with this issue in your own lives. Andrea gets us started in San Francisco. Andrea, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say that about 2 years ago, I joined Food Addict. And one of the premises that we're working with is that this is a disease and that it is incurable. And that was very helpful for me. I lost 88 pounds over the course of the next year and now hold a weight of 135 pounds, but only by every day treating this as a disease and being involved in the treatment of it. And I think that it's fine. It's actually great to treat it as a disease as long as we get the idea that this is incurable. And if you get involved with treatment, you're going to have to be involved with treatment forever. Otherwise, just revert to where you were.
Andrea, thank you. Alyssa Apple, a response to Andrea's comment.
I think that's a great example, and many, many people would have your experience, which is that this is a chronic daily management that takes a tremendous amount of effort if you're going to bring your BMI down. People who bring their BMI down by 10%, they're still in the obese category. They still may look very heavy, but they have made significant dramatic improvements in their metabolic health. So, you know, using BMI as a proxy for disease is so crude. It's really about looking into the blood. Is there insulin resistance? Is there fatty liver disease? And those things can be changed by fitness and diet and small weight loss, not by necessarily changing your BMI category. So we're really run by this disease model. That is a dominant, the healthcare model that we're not going to change. So calling it a disease is just a desperate move. But we just can't seem to prioritize prevention. And so calling it a disease can help. It causes red flags and it causes people to also recognize, like the caller said, that they're dealing with something that is chronic and very, very difficult to reverse.
And I will hold you there with that thought because we have to take a short break. When we continue, we'll pick up on that point. Is it a desperate move, but one that may be necessary, or will it do more harm than good? We'll continue our conversation on whether or not we should think of obesity as a disease. If not, how should we contend with that condition? 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the American Medical Association's decision last week to classify obesity as a disease. Our conversation this morning is focused on whether or not that decision is going to be helpful or harmful. Will it help us contend with being overweight, or does it medicalize that condition in such a way and stigmatize that condition in such a way that it winds up doing more harm than good? We welcome your participation in our conversation. You can join us at 866-733-6786. Particularly interested in if you have contended with this in your your own life. That's a perspective we'd love to hear. You can email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can also post your thoughts or comments on our Facebook page or on our website. Before the break, Virgie Tovar, we heard Andrea tell her story that for her it was very helpful to define this as a disease because it told her that this was something that wasn't curable, that she'd have to contend with this her entire life. And coming to that understanding allowed her to lose 88 pounds. When you hear a story like Andrea's, do you say, way to go, or what?
No, I actually don't. I sort of think that if Andrea feels a personal success, I would like to enjoy that success with her. But for me, the idea of weight loss does not inherently hold meaning of success for me. And I think that this gets to the heart of the very problematic nature of this decision, because we as a culture are experiencing this decision through the lens of fat phobia, through the lens that weight loss is the ultimate, not only health accomplishment, but personal accomplishment and demarcation of success and discipline.
Virgie Tovar, editor of the anthology Hot and Heavy. It's a really interesting point, Alyssa Apple, about sort of how what the prize is that we should keep our eyes on. In
right.
other words, is it the 88 pound loss? Not to unduly dwell on Andrea's story, but it's an interesting one. Or whether or not the measure of success ought to be I can now run a mile.
Right. Virgie, you bring up such an important point. Obesity can be benign. Obesity can be pathological. And partly we have to go in and measure the both psychological and medical profile. Is there underlying metabolic disease? That has to be treated. Is there underlying profile of addiction? People suffer from obsessive thoughts about food, preoccupation, this drive. They don't feel like they can control their eating. It's miserable. And this plagues a significant number of people with obesity, especially on the higher ends. We now view it as a neurobiological condition where the reward system is changed and blunted and needs more stimulation or what we call highly palatable food for the same response. So we know so much more about the neurobiology of, I don't want to say obesity, but of some subtypes of obesity that leads to both health problems and psychological distress. We can't call all obesity benign. We really have to look further and look at the subtypes. We even know in children with morbid obesity, there are changes in brain structure and cognitive function. We must take this seriously. That's why I feel like the dramatic overreaction of labeling it as a disease is just where our society is. This has to lead to positive change.
Let's go to Maria next in San Jose. Maria, go ahead, please.
Yes. Hi, good morning. I just wanted to make the comment that we actually do have a precedent for stigmatizing an illness such as obesity. I'm an obese woman, and when I found out that they had determined that it was a disease, I felt incredibly relieved. And the reason why is about 20 years ago, I used to smoke. And smoking has become stigmatized. And I'm sure that the peer pressure against smoking is what helped me to finally kick that habit. So I feel as though if obesity is now going to become classified as a disease, as opposed to a failure of character or willpower or what have you, then I'll have better tools to, you know, get my weight under control, improve my fitness, and fit in with my peers.
So in a sense, are you saying, Maria, that that definition allows you to feel like this isn't a character flaw on my part? This is an actual medical condition, and that will allow you to go about doing what you feel you need to do?
Absolutely. And the other piece of it is that, you know, when obesity is considered unacceptable, just as cigarette smoking is unacceptable, then there is a lot of pressure to, you know, not stop at the bakery, for example, you know, instead get fruit. You know, I mean, you're sort of a creature of your peers and your environment. And if the whole community is celebrating fitness and eating healthy, then you will too.
Maria, thank you. Thanks for contributing that to our conversation. Christine Mattson, as a pediatrician, I'm curious about that and how you see that with kids in particular. Maria was making the point that this will help her because it will allow her to feel like she has a disease and a condition, and that will be useful. How do you see that with kids? Will it be something that's useful with kids that will allow them to move in a more positive direction, or no?
Well, I love the idea that this could make people focus on celebrating fitness and eating healthy, which is, you know, how Maria sort of closed it out. I love that. But I think that the unintended consequence is that it won't focus on that, and instead it could lead to further stigma. For kids, it's particularly concerning because kids really, they're also, you know, products of their families. And they're not just exposed to the genetics that come from their families, but also to the environment that their family is in. And we know that actually the biggest risk factor for being an obese child is having an obese parent. So to the extent that kids have less control but may feel more stigma, I mean, adolescence is a horrible time to be worrying about your body size. I think that's a big concern, particularly because for some kids they are healthy even though they're heavier than their peers. And they really want to look like the models that we see on the billboards and in the magazines. And they're never going to look that way, not without, you know, doing horrible things to their bodies. And that's the big concern with, you know, now labeling this as a disease, saying your child has a disease. Well, your child's not going to be able to get rid of that disease because your child's actually healthy.
James in Malibu is next. James, you're on.
Yeah, I've been in the fitness industry for 15 years. I've trained hundreds of people. And this whole idea of obesity being a disease is ridiculous to me. Whether or not you're fit is a decision. If you biopsy people, we're almost identical. So if you're heavy, if you're fat, if you're fit, you're almost the same person. The difference is heavy people, fat people, make fat decisions all the time.
Oh, God.
don't oh God me, ma'am.
Hang on one second. Go ahead, James. Finish up, please.
I listen to you. Listen to me. I hundreds of people. The decision is in your head. Now, I will allow for the fact that people have a lot of things going on in their head, and they stay heavy for a myriad of reasons. That is true. Absolutely. They have things going on, personal things. But from a physiological standpoint, there is no fat person, skinny person. There's people making decisions that affect how their bodies are.
All right, James, thank you. I'm going to hold you there and get some response to that, because, Virgie Tovar, I mean, you and James are aligned on one point of this, which is that it's not a disease. It's a decision. What is it that James said that struck you as being so off-putting?
Well, I didn't say that it was a decision. So, I mean, I think that there's a little bit of difference. I agree that it's ridiculous. I think that, I don't know, when I hear statements like that, I think, is there no room for body diversity of any kind globally? Does every single body, ideally, if we made every decision that was quote unquote right or quote unquote healthy, would there be absolutely no variation in our bodies at all? Is my question.
Understood. My question back to you would be, how then do you define what is healthy? Do you define it not obviously by body size and shape or weight, but do you concur with James or others who say, or I believe both Dr. Madsen and Professor Appel, that fitness is really key? Do you concur with that? Do you think that there is a need for you or others who are struggling with that? I shouldn't say struggle, should
I? I'm not struggling.
Yeah, exactly right. Fair enough. So my question is then, do you feel like you need to be able to go out and run a mile?
You know, again, I think this comes back to my being a feminist social scientist. I have very complicated feelings about an idea like health because I see the history of the word health, and it's in a racist, sexist, ableist context. And it's also in a very classist context. When I look at an idea like health, it is something that is a top-down decided entity. People who determine what health is, and especially what health looks like, are a very particular subset of people. They are not the people who are most affected by fatness or obesity or the stigma related to those things.
All right. Well, come back on that, Dr. Appel, about it. What should we keep our eyes focused on here? Is it fitness? What is it if health can be defined in lots of ways and there are all these social and cultural implications for all of this? What is it important for every person to be most focused on?
It's a great question. And I think that, you know, fitness is a huge part of the equation that we ignore. I love James' point. I'm so glad you said this, James, because what you are saying represents how people naturally feel by default, which is it's the individuals have total free will, and at an individual level, it's your fault if you're obese, right? That's very hard for us to get rid of that belief. But if we step back, we can see the power of the social context, and it's astounding. As I said, if I know your zip code, I can predict your BMI range. What does that mean about your free will? If you live in a certain neighborhood with limited choices and low income, these are not the people who are at your gym and who pay you to help them for fitness because they can. They don't.
So that's not a choice. I mean, your zip code isn't necessarily something you can control or can make choices about.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So the social environment and the social determinants are much bigger than the individual determinants in at a population level. That our obesity epidemic is patterned by our resources. So, James, I think that you, your point is well taken, and my response is people don't have total free will. It's what we see. It's hard for us to believe that they don't, but they don't. Look at the social epidemiology data.
Let me read some comments that are coming in on our website and by email and on our Facebook page. Nani writes, if it's a disease, that removes the stigma. A disease is something that's not our fault. Then it increases the motivation to look for help from others. Another listener writes, obesity is not a lifestyle. It's not a choice, not really. Everybody eats when they're hungry and stops when they're full. Only some accumulate large amounts of body fat. Only those who have to work hard to maintain lean bodies, whether you have a propensity for obesity, is not a choice. We asked on our Facebook page, by the way, should obesity be classified as a disease? Here are some of the things that people have posted on our forum Facebook page. Amelia says, is alcoholism a disease? Is addiction a disease? Is low socioeconomic status a disease? Is lack of education a disease? Ted writes, no, obesity is a symptom, whether caused by physical issues such as an underactive thyroid or psychological issues. Those are the underlying issues that need to be treated. And Marissa adds, sure, if self-inflicted health-related problems can be considered a disease, then it is. Or maybe is being weak-willed the actual disease? Many more comments coming in. Let's go next to Carrie in San Jose. Carrie.
Hi. I am a little bit skeptical of the designation. I do believe in prevention, and like James and I believe Maria was saying, fitness and the social influence and norms can all be solved through prevention and community programs. But specifically, I see implications for the workplace in this designation. I see it possibly falling under the disability realm, which could mean workplace accommodations and or discrimination complaints, and possibly giving employees resources to go seek that treatment for obesity, or because ADA is very broad, possibly opening up a floodgates of perceived discrimination complaints and those sort of things.
Yeah, interesting points, Carrie. I'm interested in thoughts on that. Dr. Madsen, do you see this as being something that will push societal norms or the regulatory environment in the way Carrie is suggesting? In other words, would this fall then under ADA? How would that play out? Will it push, you know, more Mayor Bloomberg-type initiatives as they have in New York to regulate, you know, soda pop and so forth? Do you think this will push us, I guess, to consider certain actions, whether they be regulatory or within the workplace?
Well, I hope that it does push some of those actions. I think that regulation in this country is probably, it's a long time coming, and I think we may need it. I think it can help if it's understood that it is somewhat beyond people's control. So one thing I did in response to James' point, I totally agree with him that fitness is a decision. I think that you can be fit at any size. But I think it's important to know that in scientific studies that have actually looked at people's energy expenditure, which means how many calories you burn in a day, if we look at how many calories people burn in a day and you take somebody who, you know, same size, same lean mass, it varies by up to 1,000 calories a day. Our energy expenditure, or the number of calories we burn. So eating the same diet, two people may actually have completely different outcomes. So if our understanding of this, you know, obesity as a disease includes sort of understanding that it's not all personal responsibility, it's not all about the choices that you make, and the regulations actually work to change the environment and make it easier to be healthy at any size, I'm all for it.
Carrie, thanks for the call. We're going to go next to Elise in Los Gatos. Elise?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
So I could go on and on about this topic, but I wanted to focus particularly on the effect of the food environment on our kids. So a year ago, I embarked on a journey to lose weight that I've struggled with for years, and I'm happy to say that I lost and maintained 60-pound loss purely through diet change and being aware of what I'm eating. And I did it because I wanted to be that role model for my two young girls. So what I learned in the process was not, I want to show them that I have discipline and I have and I have that willpower. I realized how much sugar and processed ingredients are in everything. And if we don't put our focus and our money on that, this is just going to absolutely spiral out of control. I have so many friends who say, oh, you know, everything in moderation, when I tell them how I lost this weight and maintained it, and it's been by removing processed carbohydrates and sugars out of my diet. And you know what? That's sort of true, except for when we were growing up, moderation meant a little bit of this, a little bit of that. To actually eat processed foods and sugars in moderation is a full-time job in our current environment, and it's a tragedy.
Elise, thank you. Vrishi Tovar, is that part of what you would like to focus on in terms of the general environment and particularly people who live in poorer communities, that this question of choice is only gets at part of it? Because if what's before you is only unhealthy choices, you don't have a lot of choice.
Right, absolutely. The other day I was visiting a small town in, you know, Sacramento, like near Sacramento, and I was overhearing a conversation that was happening at a bus stop. I was at an ATM, and they were literally trying to figure out if they had enough money to go to maybe the food outlet, which is sort of, you know, it's not a great market, but it's for lower income folks. And it has a lot of these high fructose corn syrup infused, a lot of sort of foods that I would consider not nutritious. And they were trying to figure out if they could afford to get chicken and, you know, a can of corn. This is where many, I would even venture to say most Americans are at. Most Americans are at the poverty line or below it. And I think that's really something that needs to be contemplated. Additionally, I agree in terms of...
Well, not most. I mean, not by official federal definitions.
All right, you're right. I think that what we're talking about with the food supply, I think it's very complicated when we're talking about public health and the mandates that come from departments of the government, and we're not looking at the way that the government subsidizes corn production, which produces high fructose corn syrup and promotes the production of things like high fructose corn syrup, which are known to be potentially toxic.
Elise, thanks. Thank you for raising that. We're going to go next to Janine, who wants us to bring us back to the subject of kids and how kids are taught to eat. Janine, go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a physical education teacher and an exercise physiologist. And when I taught elementary school, I was seeing young kids coming in kindergarten, first grade, already obese. And, you know, it's really difficult. Start teaching them then and get them doing all their physical activities in school. And I don't know, you know, any other place, but in Florida, they're still talking about even cutting back physical education they cut it back from every day when I was in school in elementary level to twice a week. And now they're thinking about cutting it out completely again. And what my concern is, if they make it official as a disease, that these kids with the label of being fat, then they're going to use that more as a crutch, saying, oh, well, there's nothing I can do. It's a disease.
Yeah.
I can't help myself.
Janine, thank you. It's interesting to hear that perspective of someone who works with kids in physical education. Christine Madsen, as a pediatrician, what's the conversation that you have? If a child walks in with their parent, presumably, and they're weight is something that you perceive to be a potential health concern. What do you say? How do you start the conversation? What is it that you want them to hear and to think about?
So I think we try to focus on what we think of as the big players in the development of obesity. So we do talk about getting rid of sugar-sweetened beverages. We, you know, kids should not be drinking their calories. So that's one of our the priority. We also focus on physical activity and mostly on getting kids out from in front of the TV. You know, the American Academy of Pediatrics says no more than 2 hours a day of screen time, but most of our kids are getting something like 7 or 8. So that's another important focus. And then we do talk a lot about junk food and just, you know, making sure that kids have healthy food at the table and that they don't have a bunch of snacks. And I do think that if everybody had that approach and everybody were able to afford the food, you know, that was healthy food, I don't think we'd have nearly the epidemic that we have.
Do you have a sense of when a light goes on in a child's eyes? Do you have a sense of that moment and what it is that creates that awareness?
So, unfortunately, I don't think I've never seen a light go on a kid's eyes. I mean, this, you know, we do studies. You put an apple out and you put a donut out, the kids are going to choose the donut 9 times out of 10. And that's why it's really, for kids, it's creating a healthy environment so that they do have a healthy choice, or that all their choices are healthy and then they're just choosing the thing they like among, you know, many healthy options.
Let me read some other comments that are coming in on our website, Facebook page, email. Mary writes, the reasons for obesity are varied and yet need to be properly understood without personal judgment on the part of the diagnostician. I observed and ultimately scolded my 2 daughters' pediatrician, who treated my girls differently. One was naturally waif-like and the other was increasingly chubby as she approached puberty, while I knew they ate the same healthy diet, participated in sports, and so forth. So that's interesting, Christine Madison. Madison, how do you respond to that? That you have to, I'm sure that's something that you probably also are really focused on exercise and care about.
Right. Well, I think that goes back to the point I made earlier where there's big variation in how many calories a person burns based totally on their genetics, right? So if there's really, for adults, 1,000 calorie difference in how much people burn, you're right. Exposing kids to the same diet in the same environment still can produce different kids based on genes. And that's why I really keep going back to let's make sure kids are fit. And I totally agree with Virgie that there will always be, and there always should be, size diversity. I don't expect, if everybody ate the same thing, there is no way we would all look the same. That's not how our bodies come. So the focus needs to be instead on a healthy lifestyle, everybody out walking as a family, taking out the dog, and really focusing more on the lifestyle behaviors we can control.
And to Allison in Oakland. Allison.
Hi, yes. I was concerned about the adding this as a disease code, that this will lead to a further one-size-fits-all approach. So are they going to be primarily approaching it from an addiction model, that this is primarily overeating issue, or is it primarily a genetic issue,
yeah,
more like diabetes or a behavioral health issue that people just need to be educated?
Yeah, thank you, Allison. Alyssa Apple, your thoughts on that? I mean,
I think it's a great question. I think the policy, the label could have different effects. The best possible outcome of labeling obesity as a disease is that the people who are now paying for obesity, the health insurance and healthcare industry, will make the food industry accountable.
Huh.
The root cause of obesity is that we have a toxic food environment. Elise said it well. It's a full-time job to get sugars out of the food. And so who's profiting from obesity? The food industry. The biggest bane for the buck is if we can now put pressure on them and regulate food and get the sugars out, which are in any processed or packaged food, you often find added sugar.
That's a really interesting thought.
The other piece is that we can view junk food as unacceptable, just like smoke. It harms people, and so we can help each other by not having it in public places. We should treat junk food like smoke and contact smoke. It hurts other people. It shouldn't be served in any institutions or public places.
Virgie Tofar, how do you respond to that part of this? That this could be a useful sort of club to bang the food industry over the head and to regulate it further. If that's the culprit, the sort of super sweetened food that we all see in the store, that this might push those folks.
Yeah, I don't know. I actually would like to kind of problematize or look at the idea of harm. And I think it's a very, very complicated issue. When you're looking at food, you're not just looking at availability, supply. You're looking at a psychological sort of social element of what food means to different people. And there are plenty of theorists. Bell Hooks, for example, is one of them, who talks about the way that delicious food may be one of the only sources of pleasure to a child or a person who's living perhaps a very violent life or a very socioeconomically affected, negatively lifestyle. So when I think about some of the most marginalized children, let's say, or some of the most marginalized people, we're talking about what access do these people have to the American dream? What access do they have to pleasure or things that are positive or delicious? And I feel like these are things that complicate things like fitness and health and harm.
Understood. I appreciate the context you're bringing to that. But I guess I still want to ask my question, which is, couldn't this be something that by focusing our attention pushes the food industry in a way that would be more healthy?
I suppose it's possible.
Okay. We'll leave it at that thought and get back to our calls. Margo in Pleasant Hill. Go ahead, please.
This is Margo from Pleasant Hill. I'm a doctorally prepared nurse and I'm a proud graduate of UCSF, and I did study health and also coping and overeating. I've kept off 75 pounds myself for 23 years. I'd like to make a couple of points. One is health.
Why don't you just give us a very brief one, because we're just about out of time.
Okay, health is more than the absence of disease. We need to distinguish between medical and social definitions of obesity. Mm-hmm. Obesity is a chronic condition, and also I think the importance of this decision by the AMA is really, as has been stated before, for public policy.
And Margo, we'll have to hold you there. I'm sorry to cut you off so short, but we're just about out of time. Fascinating discussion. I appreciate so much all of you participating in it, our listeners, as well as our guests, Dr. Christine Mattson, Professor Alyssa Appel, and Virgie Tovar. Thanks all very much for adding your perspective to this program. Really interesting conversation. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Howard Gelman is our engineer. Dan Zoll, our senior editor. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. Amanda Stupai, our engagement producer. I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.